This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, Valis, by Philip K. Dick. Copyright 1981, by Philip K. Dick. All rights reserved. Narrated by James D. Lotell. This book contains 241 pages on 7 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Annotation. In the first of a trio of novels inspired by a mystical experience Dick had, the protagonist is a science fiction author named Philip. When his suicidal alter ego, horse lover Fat, encounters a higher being, and the event is eerily duplicated in a science fiction film entitled Valis, Vast Active Living Intelligence System, Philip visits the film's creators to investigate. Strong language, 1981. From the book jacket. Although known during his lifetime as a writer of science fiction, and more recently as the inspiration for such films as Blade Runner and Total Recall, Philip K. Dick properly belongs in the tradition of Vonnegut, Calvino, and Robertson Davies. His novels place touchingly ordinary men and women in intimate congress with the unknowable and the awful. Valis is the first book in Philip K. Dick's incomparable final trio of novels. The others are The Divine Invasion and The Transmigration of Timothy Archer. This disorienting and bleakly funny work is about a schizophrenic hero named Horse Lover Fat, the hidden mysteries of Gnostic Christianity, and reality as revealed through a pink laser. Valis is a theological detective story in which God is both a missing person and the perpetrator of the ultimate crime. About the author. Philip K. Dick was born in Chicago in 1928 and lived most of his life in California. He briefly attended the University of California, but dropped out before completing any classes. In 1952, he began writing professionally and proceeded to write 36 novels and 5 short story collections. He won the Hugo Award for Best Novel in 1962 for The Man in the High Castle, and the John W. Campbell Memorial Award for Best Novel of the Year in 1974 for Flow My Tears, the Policeman Said. The Valis trilogy was inspired by a mystical experience that Dick had in March of 1974, and described as an invasion of my mind by a transcendentally rational mind. Philip K. Dick died of heart failure following a stroke on March 2, 1982, in Santa Ana, California. Dedication to Russell Galen, who showed me the right way. Valis, acronym of Vast Active Living Intelligence System, from an American film, a perturbation in the reality field in which a spontaneous self-monitoring negentropic vortex is formed, tending progressively to subsume and incorporate its environment into arrangements of information, characterized by quasi-consciousness, purpose, intelligence, growth, and an armillary coherence. Great Soviet Dictionary, 6th edition, 1992. 1. Horse Lover Fat's nervous breakdown began the day he got the phone call from Gloria asking if he had any Nembutals. He asked her why she wanted them, and she said that she intended to kill herself. She was calling everyone she knew. By now she had 50 of them, but she needed 30 or 40 more to be on the safe side. At once, Horse Lover Fat leaped to the conclusion that this was her way of asking for help. It had been Fat's delusion for years that he could help people. His psychiatrist once told him that to get well he would have to do 2 things: get off dope, which he hadn't done, and to stop trying to help people. He still tried to help people. As a matter of fact, he had no Nembutals. He had no sleeping pills of any sort. He never did sleeping pills. He did uppers. So giving Gloria sleeping pills by which she could kill herself was beyond his power. Anyhow, he wouldn't have done it if he could. "I have 10," he said, because if he told her the truth, she would hang up. "Then I'll drive up to your place," Gloria said in a rational, calm voice, the same tone in which she had asked for the pills. He realized then that she was not asking for help. She was trying to die. She was completely crazy. If she were sane, she would realize that it was necessary to veil her purpose, because this way she made him guilty of complicity. For him to agree, he would need to want her dead. No motive existed for him, or anyone, to want that. Gloria was gentle and civilized, but she dropped a lot of acid. It was obvious that the acid, since he had last heard from her 6 months ago, had wrecked her mind. "What have you been doing?" Fat asked.
"I've been in Mount Zion Hospital in San Francisco. I tried suicide, and my mother committed me. They discharged me last week."
"Are you cured?" he said.
"Yes," she said.
That's when Fat began to go nuts. At the time, he didn't know it, but he had been drawn into an unspeakable psychological game. There was no way out. Gloria Knudsen had wrecked him, her friend, along with her own brain. Probably she had wrecked 6 or 7 other people, all friends who loved her, along the way, with similar phone conversations. She had undoubtedly destroyed her mother and father as well. Fat heard in her rational tone the harp of nihilism, the twang of the void. He was not dealing with a person. He had a reflex arc thing at the other end of the phone line. What he did not know then is that it is sometimes an appropriate response to reality to go insane. To listen to Gloria rationally ask to die was to inhale the contagion. It was a Chinese finger trap, where the harder you pull to get out, the tighter the trap gets. "Where are you now?" he asked.
"Modesto, at my parents' home."
Since he lived in Marin County, she was several hours' drive away. Few inducements would have gotten him to make such a drive. This was another serving up of lunacy, 3 hours' drive each way for 10 Nimbutols. Why not just total the car? Gloria was not even committing her irrational act rationally. "Thank you, Tim Leary," Fat thought. "You and your promotion of the joy of expanded consciousness through dope." He did not know his own life was on the line. This was 1971. In 1972, he would be up north in Vancouver, British Columbia, involved in trying to kill himself, alone, poor and scared, in a foreign city. Right now, he was spared that knowledge. All he wanted to do was coax Gloria up to Marin County so he could help her. One of God's greatest mercies is that he keeps us perpetually occluded. In 1976, totally crazy with grief, horse lover Fat would slit his wrist, the Vancouver suicide attempt having failed, take 49 tablets of high-grade digitalis, and sit in a closed garage with his car motor running, and fail there, too. Well, the body has powers unknown to the mind. Gloria's mind had total control over her body. She was rationally insane. Most insanity can be identified with the bizarre and the theatrical. You put a pan on your head and a towel around your waist, paint yourself purple, and go outdoors. Gloria was as calm as she had ever been, polite and civilized. If she had lived in ancient Rome or Japan, she would have gone unnoticed. Her driving skills probably remained unimpaired. She would stop at every red light and not exceed the speed limit on her trip to pick up the 10 Nimbutols. "I am horse lover Fat, and I am writing this in the third person to gain much-needed objectivity. I did not love Gloria Knudsen, but I liked her. In Berkeley, she and her husband had given elegant parties, and my wife and I always got invited. Gloria spent hours fixing little sandwiches and served different wines, and she dressed up and looked lovely with her sandy-colored, short-cut curly hair. Anyhow, horse lover Fat had no Nimbutol to give her, and a week later, Gloria threw herself out of a 10th-floor window of the Synanon building in Oakland, California, and smashed herself to bits on the pavement along MacArthur Boulevard, and horse lover Fat continued his insidious, long decline into misery and illness, the sort of chaos that astrophysicists say is the fate in store for the whole universe. Fat was ahead of his time, ahead of the universe. Eventually, he forgot what event had started off his decline into entropy. God mercifully occludes us to the past as well as the future. For 2 months, after he learned of Gloria's suicide, he cried and watched TV and took more dope. His brain was going, too, but he didn't know it. Infinite are the mercies of God. As a matter of fact, Fat had lost his own wife the year before to mental illness. It was like a plague. No one could discern how much was due to drugs. This time in America, 1960 to 1970, and this place, the Bay Area of Northern California, was totally fucked. I'm sorry to tell you this, but that's the truth. Fancy terms and ornate theories cannot cover this fact up. The authorities became as psychotic as those they hunted. They wanted to put all persons who were not clones of the establishment away. The authorities were filled with hate. Fat had seen police glower at him with the ferocity of dogs. The day they moved Angela Davis, the black Marxist, out of the Marin County Jail, the authorities dismantled the whole civic center. This was to baffle radicals who might intend trouble. The elevators got unwired, doors got relabeled with spurious information. The district attorney hid. Fat saw all this. He had gone to the Civic Center that day to return a library book. At the electronic hoop at the Civic Center entrance, two cops had ripped open the book and papers that Fat carried. He was perplexed. The whole day perplexed him. In the cafeteria, an armed cop watched everyone eat. Fat returned home by cab, afraid of his own car and wondering if he was nuts. He was, but so was everyone else. I am, by profession, a science fiction writer. I deal in fantasies. My life is a fantasy. Nonetheless, Gloria Knutson lies in a box in Modesto, California. There's a photo of her funeral wreaths in my photo album. It's a color photo, so you can see how lovely the wreaths are. In the background, a VW is parked. I can be seen crawling into the VW in the midst of the service. I am not able to take any more. After the graveside service, Gloria's former husband Bob and I, and some tearful friend of his and hers, had a late lunch at a fancy restaurant in Modesto near the cemetery. The waitress seated us in the rear because the three of us looked like hippies, even though we had suits and ties on. We didn't give a shit. I don't remember what we talked about. The night before, Bob and I mean Bob and Horse Lover Fat, drove to Oakland to see the movie Patton. Just before the graveside service, Fat met Gloria's parents for the first time. Like their deceased daughter, they treated him with utmost civility. A number of Gloria's friends stood around the corny California ranch-style living room, recalling the person who linked them together. Naturally, Mrs. Knudsen wore too much makeup. Women always put on too much makeup when someone dies. Fat petted the dead girl's cat, Chairman Mao. He remembered the few days Gloria had spent with him upon her futile trip to his house for the Nembutal, which he did not have. She greeted the disclosure of his lie with aplomb, even a neutrality. When you are going to die, you do not care about small things. "I took them," Fat had told her, lie upon lie. They decided to drive to the beach, the great ocean beach of the Point Reyes Peninsula. In Gloria's VW, with Gloria driving, it never entered his mind that she might, on impulse, wipe out him, herself, and the car. And an hour later, sat together on the sand, smoking dope. What Fat wanted to know most of all was why she intended to kill herself. Gloria had on many times washed jeans and a T-shirt with Mick Jagger's leering face across the front of it. Because the sand felt nice, she took off her shoes. Fat noticed that she had pink-painted toenails and that they were perfectly pedicured. To himself, he thought, she died as she lived. "They stole my bank account," Gloria said. After a time, he realized, from her measured, lucidly stated narration, that no they existed. Gloria unfolded a panorama of total and relentless madness, lapidary in construction. She had filled in all the details with tools as precise as dental tools. No vacuum existed anywhere in her account. He could find no error, except, of course, for the premise, which was that everyone hated her, was out to get her, and she was worthless in every respect. As she talked, she began to disappear. He watched her go. It was amazing. Gloria, in her measured way, talked herself out of existence, word by word. It was rationality at the service of, well, he thought, at the service of non-being. Her mind had become one great, expert eraser. All that really remained now was her husk, which is to say, her uninhabited corpse. She is dead now, he realized that day on the beach. After they had smoked up all their dope, they walked along and commented on seaweed and the height of waves. Seagulls croaked by overhead, sailing themselves like frisbees. A few people sat or walked here and there, but mostly the beach was deserted. Signs warned of undertow. Fat, for the life of him, could not figure out why Gloria didn't simply walk out into the surf. He simply could not get into her head. All she could think of was the Nembutal she still needed, or imagined she needed. My favorite Dead album is Working Man's Dead, Gloria said at one point. But I don't think they should advocate taking cocaine. A lot of kids listen to rock. They don't advocate it. The song's just about someone taking it. And it killed him, indirectly. He smashed up his train. But that's why I started on drugs, Gloria said. Because of the Grateful Dead? Because, Gloria said, everyone wanted me to do it. I'm tired of doing what other people want me to do. Don't kill yourself, Fat said. Move in with me. I'm all alone. I really like you. Try it for a while at least. We'll move your stuff up, me and my friends. There's lots of things we can do, like go places, like to the beach today. Isn't it nice here? To that, Gloria said nothing. It would really make me feel terrible, Fat said. For the rest of my life, if you did away with yourself. Thereby, as he later realized, he presented her with all the wrong reasons for living. She would be doing it as a favor to others. He could not have found a worse reason to give had he looked for years. Better to back the VW over her. This is why suicide hotlines are not manned by nitwits. Fat learned this later in Vancouver when, suicidal himself, he phoned the British Columbia Crisis Center and got expert advice. There was no correlation between this and what he told Gloria on the beach that day. Pausing to rub a small stone loose from her foot, Gloria said, I'd like to stay overnight at your place tonight. Hearing this, Fat experienced involuntary visions of sex. Far out, he said, which was the way he talked in those days. The counterculture possessed a whole book of phrases which bordered on meaning nothing. Fat used to string a bunch of them together. He did so now, deluded by his own carnality into imagining that he had saved his friend's life. His judgment, which wasn't worth much anyhow, dropped to a new nadir of acuity. The existence of a good person hung in the balance, hung in a balance which Fat held, and all he could think of now was the prospect of scoring. I can dig it, he prattled away as they walked. Out of sight. A few days later, she was dead. They spent that night together, sleeping, fully dressed. They did not make love. The next afternoon, Gloria drove off, ostensibly to get her stuff from her parents' house in Modesto. He never saw her again. For several days, he waited for her to show up, and then one night the phone rang, and it was her ex-husband, Bob. Where are you right now? Bob asked. The question bewildered him. He was at home, where his phone was, in the kitchen. Bob sounded calm. I'm here, Fat said. Gloria killed herself today, Bob said. I have a photo of Gloria holding Chairman Mao in her arms. Gloria is kneeling and smiling, and her eyes shine. Chairman Mao is trying to get down. To their left, part of a Christmas tree can be seen. On the back, Mrs. Knudsen has written in tidy letters, How we made her feel gratitude for our love. I've never been able to fathom whether Mrs. Knudsen wrote that after Gloria's death or before. The Knudsens mailed me the photo a month, mailed horse lover Fat the photo a month after Gloria's funeral. Fat had written asking for a photo of her. Initially, he had asked Bob, who replied in a savage tone, What do you want a picture of Gloria for? To which Fat could give no answer. When Fat got me started writing this, he asked me why I thought Bob Langley got so mad at this request. I don't know. I don't care. Maybe Bob knew that Gloria and Fat had spent a night together, and he was jealous. Fat used to say Bob Langley was a schizoid. He claimed that Bob himself told him that. A schizoid lacks proper affect to go with his thinking. He's got what's called flattening of affect. A schizoid would see no reason not to tell you that about himself. On the other hand, Bob bent down after the graveside service and put a rose on Gloria's coffin. That was about when Fat had gone crawling off to the VW. Which reaction is more appropriate? Fat weeping in the parked car by himself, or the ex-husband bending down with the rose, saying nothing, showing nothing, but doing something? Fat contributed nothing to the funeral except a bundle of flowers which he had belatedly bought on the trip down to Modesto. He had given them to Mrs. Knudsen, who remarked that they were lovely. Bob had picked them out. After the funeral, at the fancy restaurant where the waitress had moved the three of them out of view, Fat asked Bob what Gloria had been doing at Synanon, since she was supposed to be getting her possessions together and driving back up to Marin County to live with him, he had thought. Carmina talked her into going to Synanon, Bob said. That was Mrs. Knudsen, because of her history of drug involvement. Timothy, the friend Fat didn't know, said, "They sure didn't help her very much." What had happened was that Gloria walked in the front door of Synanon, and they had gamed her right off. Someone, on purpose, had walked past her as she sat waiting to be interviewed and had remarked on how ugly she was. The next person to parade past her informed her that her hair looked like something a rat slept in. Gloria had always been sensitive about her curly hair. She wished it was long like all the other hair in the world. What the third Synanon member would have said was moot, because by then Gloria had gone upstairs to the 10th floor. "Is that how Synanon works?" Fat asked. Bob said, "It's a technique to break down the personality. It's a fascist therapy that makes the person totally outer-directed and dependent on the group. Then they can build up a new personality that isn't drug-oriented." "Didn't they realize she was suicidal?" Timothy asked. "Of course," Bob said. "She phoned in and talked to them. They knew her name and why she was there." "Did you talk to them after her death?" Fat asked. Bob said, "I phoned them up and asked to talk to someone high up and told him they had killed my wife, and the man said that they wanted me to come down there and teach them how to handle suicidal people. He was super upset. I felt sorry for him." At that, hearing that, Fat decided that Bob himself was not right in the head. Bob felt sorry for Synanon. Bob was all fucked up. Everyone was fucked up, including Carmina Knudsen. There wasn't a sane person left in Northern California. It was time to move somewhere else. He sat eating his salad and wondering where he could go. Out of the country. Flee to Canada, like the draft protesters. He personally knew 10 guys who had slipped across into Canada rather than fight in Vietnam. Probably in Vancouver he would run into 6 people he knew. Vancouver was supposed to be one of the most beautiful cities in the world. Like San Francisco, it was a major port. He could start life all over and forget the past. It entered his head as he sat fooling with his salad that when Bob phoned, he hadn't said, "Gloria killed herself," but rather, "Gloria killed herself today," as if it had been inevitable that she would do it one day or another. Perhaps this had done it, this assumption. Gloria had been timed, as if she were taking a math test. Who really was the insane one? Gloria or himself? Probably himself. Or her ex-husband. Or all of them, the Bay Area. Not insane in the loose sense of the term, but in the strict technical sense. Let it be said that one of the first symptoms of psychosis is that the person feels perhaps he is becoming psychotic. It is another Chinese finger trap. You cannot think about it without becoming part of it. By thinking about madness, horse lover Fat slipped by degrees into madness. I wish I could have helped him. 2. Although there was nothing I could do to help horse lover Fat, he did escape death. The first thing that came along to save him took the form of an 18-year-old high school girl living down the street from him. And the second was God. Of the two of them, the girl did better. I'm not sure God did anything at all for him. In fact, in some ways, God made him sicker. This was a subject on which Fat and I could not agree. Fat was certain that God had healed him completely. That is not possible. There is a line in the I Ching reading, always ill but never dies. That fits my friend. Stephanie entered Fats' life as a dope dealer. After Gloria's death, he did so much dope that he had to buy from every source available to him. Buying dope from high school kids is not a smart move. It has nothing to do with dope itself, but with the law and morality. Once you begin to buy dope from kids, you are a marked man. I'm sure it's obvious why. But the thing I knew, which the authorities did not, is this. Horse lover Fat really wasn't interested in the dope that Stephanie had for sale. She dealt hash and grass, but never uppers. She did not approve of uppers. Stephanie never sold anything she did not approve of. She never sold psychedelics, no matter what pressure was put on her. Now and then she sold cocaine. Nobody could quite figure out her reasoning, but it was a form of reasoning. In the normal sense, Stephanie did not think at all. But she did arrive at decisions, and once she arrived at them, no one could budge her. Fat liked her. There lay the gist of it. He liked her, and not the dope. But to maintain a relationship with her, he had to be a buyer, which meant he had to do hash. For Stephanie, hash was the beginning and end of life. Life worth living, anyhow. If God came in a poor second, at least he wasn't doing anything illegal, as Stephanie was. Fat was convinced that Stephanie would wind up in jail. He expected her to be arrested any day. All Fat's friends expected him to be arrested any day. We worried about that and about his slow decline into depression and psychosis and isolation. Fat worried about Stephanie. Stephanie worried about the price of hash. More so, she worried about the price of cocaine. We used to imagine her suddenly sitting bolt upright in the middle of the night and exclaiming, "Coke has gone up to $100 a gram." She worried about the price of dope the way normal women worry about the price of coffee. We used to argue that Stephanie could not have existed before the 60s. Dope had brought her into being, summoned her out of the very ground. She was a coefficient of dope, part of an equation. And yet it was through her that Fat made his way eventually to God. Not through her dope. It has nothing to do with dope. There is no door to God through dope. That is a lie peddled by the unscrupulous. The means by which Stephanie brought horse lover Fat to God was by means of a little clay pot which she threw on her kick wheel, a kick wheel which Fat had helped pay for as a present on her 18th birthday. When he fled to Canada, he took the pot with him, wrapped up in shorts, socks, and shirts, in his single suitcase. It looked like an ordinary pot, squat and light brown, with a small amount of blue glaze as trim. Stephanie was not an expert potter. This pot was one of the first she threw, at least outside of her ceramics class in high school. Naturally, one of her first pots would go to Fat. She and he had a close relationship. When he'd get upset, Stephanie would quiet him down by supercharging him with her hash pipe. The pot was unusual in one way, however. In it slumbered God. He slumbered in the pot for a long time, for almost too long. There is a theory among some religions that God intervenes at the 11th hour. Maybe that is so, I couldn't say. In Horse Lover Fat's case, God waited until 3 minutes before 12, and even then what he did was barely enough and virtually too late. You can't hold Stephanie responsible for that. She threw the pot, glazed it, and fired it as soon as she had the kick wheel. She did her best to help her friend Fat, who, like Gloria before him, was beginning to die. She helped her friend the way Fat had tried to help his friend, only Stephanie did a better job. But that was the difference between her and Fat. In a crisis, she knew what to do. Fat did not. Therefore, Fat is alive today, and Gloria is not. Fat had a better friend than Gloria had had. Perhaps he would have wanted it the other way around, but the option was not his. We do not serve up people to ourselves. The universe does. The universe makes certain decisions, and on the basis of these decisions, some people live and some people die. This is a harsh law, but every creature yields to it out of necessity. Fat got God, and Gloria Knudsen got death. It is unfair, and Fat would be the first person to say so. Give him credit for that. After he had encountered God, Fat developed a love for him which was not normal. It is not what is usually meant in saying that someone loves God. With Fat, it was an actual hunger.
And stranger still, he explained to us that God had injured him, and still he yearned for him, like a drunk yearns for booze. God, he told us, had fired a beam of pink light directly at him, at his head, his eyes. Fat had been temporarily blinded, and his head had ached for days. It was easy, he said, to describe the beam of pink light. It's exactly what you get as a phosphine afterimage when a flashbulb has gone off in your face. Fat was spiritually haunted by that color. Sometimes it showed up on a TV screen. He lived for that light, that one particular color. However, he could never really find it again. Nothing could generate that color for light but God. In other words, normal light did not contain that color. One time, Fat studied a color chart, a chart of the visible spectrum. The color was absent. He had seen a color which no one can see. It lay off the end. What comes after light in terms of frequency? Heat? Radio waves? I should know, but I don't. Fat told me, I don't know how true this is, that in the solar spectrum what he saw was above 700 millimicrons, in terms of Fraunhofer lines, past B in the direction of A. Make of that what you will. I deem it a symptom of Fat's breakdown. People suffering nervous breakdowns often do a lot of research to find explanations for what they are undergoing. The research, of course, fails. It fails as far as we are concerned, but the unhappy fact is that it sometimes provides a spurious rationalization to the disintegrating mind, like Gloria's they. I looked up the Fraunhofer lines one time, and there is no A. The earliest letter indication that I could find is B. It goes from G to B, from ultraviolet to infrared. That's it. There is no more. What Fant saw, or thought he saw, was not light. After he returned from Canada, after he got God, Fat and I spent a lot of time together, and in the course of our going out at night, a regular event with us, cruising for action, seeing what was happening, we one time were in the process of parking my car when all at once a spot of pink light showed up on my left arm. I knew what it was, although I had never seen such a thing before. Someone had turned a laser beam on us. "That's a laser," I said to Fat, who had seen it too, since the spot was moving all around, onto telephone poles and the cement wall of the garage. Two teenagers stood at the far end of the street, holding a square object between them. "They built the goddamn thing," I said. The kids walked up to us, grinning. They had built it, they told us, from a kit. We told them how impressed we were, and they walked off to spook someone else. "That color pink?" I asked Fat. He said nothing, but I had the impression that he was not being upfront with me. I had the feeling that I had seen his color. Why he would not say so, if such it was, I do not know. Maybe the notion spoiled a more elegant theory. The mentally disturbed do not employ the principle of scientific parsimony, the most simple theory to explain a given set of facts. They shoot for the Baroque. The cardinal point which Fat had made to us regarding his experience with the pink beam which had injured and blinded him was this. He claimed that instantly, as soon as the beam struck him, he knew things he had never known. He knew specifically that his 5-year-old son had an undiagnosed birth defect, and he knew what that birth defect consisted of, down to the anatomical details, down, in fact, to the medical specifics to relate to the doctor. I wanted to see how he told it to the doctor, how he explained knowing the medical details. His brain had trapped all the information the beam of pink light had nailed him with, but how would he account for it? Fat later developed a theory that the universe is made out of information. He started keeping a journal, had been, in fact, secretly doing so for some time, the furtive act of a deranged person. His encounter with God was all there, on the pages, in his, Fat's, not God's, handwriting. The term journal is mine, not Fat's. His term was exegesis, a theological term meaning a piece of writing that explains or interprets a portion of Scripture. Fat believed that the information fired at him and progressively crammed into his head in successive waves had a holy origin, and hence should be regarded as a form of Scripture, even if it just applied to his son's undiagnosed right inguinal hernia,
which had popped the hydroseal and gone down into the scrotal sac. This was the news Fat had for the doctor. The news turned out to be correct, as was confirmed when Fat's ex-wife took Christopher in to be examined. Surgery was scheduled for the next day, which is to say, as soon as possible. The surgeon cheerfully informed Fat and his ex-wife that Christopher's life had been in danger for years. He could have died during the night from a strangulated piece of his own gut. It was fortunate, the surgeon said, that they had found out about it. Thus again, Gloria's they, except that in this instance the they actually existed. The surgery came off a success, and Christopher stopped being such a complaining child. He had been in pain since birth. After that, Fat and his ex-wife took their son to another GP, one who had eyes. One of the paragraphs in Fat's journal impressed me enough to copy it out and include it here. It does not deal with right inguinal hernias, but is more general in nature, expressing Fat's growing opinion that the nature of the universe is information. He had begun to believe this because for him the universe, his universe, was indeed fast turning into information. Once God started talking to him, he never seemed to stop. I don't think they report that in the Bible. Journal Entry 37. Thoughts of the brain are experienced by us as arrangements and rearrangements, change, in a physical universe. But in fact, it is really information, and information processing, which we substantialize. We do not merely see its thoughts as objects, but rather as the movement, or, more precisely, the placement of objects, how they become linked to one another. But we cannot read the patterns of arrangement. We cannot extract the information in it, i.e., it as information, which is what it is. The linking and relinking of objects by the brain is actually a language, but not a language like ours, since it is addressing itself and not someone or something outside itself. Fat kept working this particular theme over and over again, both in this journal and in his oral discourse to his friends. He felt sure the universe had begun to talk to him. Another entry in his journal reads, 36. We should be able to hear this information, or rather narrative, as a neutral voice inside us. But something has gone wrong. All creation is a language, and nothing but a language, which for some inexplicable reason we can't read outside and can't hear inside. So, I say, we have become idiots. Something has happened to our intelligence. My reasoning is this. Arrangement of parts of the brain is a language. We are parts of the brain. Therefore, we are language. Why, then, do we not know this? We do not even know what we are, let alone what the outer reality is of which we are parts. The origin of the word idiot is the word private. Each of us has become private and no longer shares the common thought of the brain, except at a subliminal level. Thus our real life and purpose are conducted below our threshold of consciousness. To which I personally am tempted to say, speak for yourself, Fat. Over a long period of time, or deserts of vast eternity, as he would have put it, Fat developed a lot of unusual theories to account for his contact with God, and the information derived therefrom. One in particular struck me as interesting, being different from the others. It amounted to a kind of mental capitulation by Fat to what he was undergoing. This theory held that in actuality he wasn't experiencing anything at all. Sites of his brain were being selectively stimulated by tight energy beams emanating from far off, perhaps millions of miles away. These selective brain site stimulations generated in his head the impression, for him, that he was in fact seeing and hearing words, pictures, figures of people, printed pages, in short, God and God's message, or as Fat liked to call it, the Logos. But, this particular theory held, he really only imagined he experienced these things. They resembled holograms. What struck me was the oddity of a lunatic discounting his hallucinations in this sophisticated manner. Fat had intellectually dealt himself out of the game of madness while still enjoying its sights and sounds. In effect, he no longer claimed that what he experienced was actually there. Did this indicate he had begun to get better? Hardly. Now he held the view that they, or God, or someone, owned a long-range, very tight, information-rich beam of energy, focused on Fat's head. In this I saw no improvement, but it did represent a change. Fat could now honestly discount his hallucinations, which meant he recognized them as such. But, like Gloria, he now had a they. It seemed to me a Pyrrhic victory. Fat's life struck me as a litany of exactly that, as, for example, the way he had rescued Gloria. The exegesis Fat labored on month after month struck me as a Pyrrhic victory, if there ever was one. In this case, an attempt by a beleaguered mind to make sense out of the inscrutable. Perhaps this is the bottom line to mental illness. Incomprehensible events occur. Your life becomes a bin for hoax-like fluctuations of what used to be reality. And not only that, as if that weren't enough, but you, like Fat, ponder forever over these fluctuations in an effort to order them into a coherency, when in fact the only sense they make is the sense you impose on them, out of the necessity to restore everything into shapes and processes you can recognize. The first thing to depart in mental illness is the familiar, and what takes its place is bad news, because not only can you not understand it, you also cannot communicate it to other people. The madman experiences something, but what it is or where it comes from, he does not know. In the midst of his shattered landscape, which one can trace back to Gloria Knudsen's death, Fat imagined God had cured him. Once you notice Pyrrhic victories, they seem to abound. It reminds me of a girl I once knew who was dying of cancer. I visited her in the hospital and did not recognize her. Sitting up in her bed, she looked like a little old hairless man. From the chemotherapy, she had swollen up like a great grape. From the cancer and the therapy, she had become virtually blind, nearly deaf, underwent constant seizures, and when I bent close to her to ask how she felt, she answered, when she could understand my question, "I feel that God is healing me." She had been religiously inclined and had planned to go into a religious order. On the middle stand beside her bed, she had, or someone had, laid out her rosary. In my opinion, a "fuck you, God" sign would have been appropriate. The rosary was not. Yet, in all fairness, I have to admit that God, or someone calling himself God, a distinction of mere semantics, had fired precious information at horse-lover Fat's head by which their son Christopher's life had been saved. Some people God cures, and some he slays. Fat denies that God slays anyone. Fat says God never harms anyone. Illness, pain, and undeserved suffering arise not from God, but from elsewhere. To which I say, how did this elsewhere arise? Are there two gods? Or is part of the universe out from under God's control? Fat used to quote Plato. In Plato's cosmology, noos, or mind, is persuading ananke, or blind necessity, or blind chance, according to some experts, into submission. Noos happened to come along and, to its surprise, discovered blind chance, chaos, in other words, onto which noos imposes order, although how this persuading is done, Plato nowhere says. According to Fat, my friend's cancer consisted of disorder not yet persuaded into sentient shape. Noos, or God, had not yet gotten around to her, to which I said, well, when he did get around to her, it was too late. Fat had no answer for that, at least in terms of oral rebuttal. Probably he sneaked off and wrote about it in his journal. He stayed up to 4 a.m. every night, scratching away in his journal. I suppose all the secrets of the universe lay in it, somewhere, amid the rubble. We enjoyed baiting Fat into theological disputation, because he always got angry, taking the point of view that what we said on the topic mattered, that the topic itself mattered. By now, he had become totally whacked out. We enjoyed introducing the discussion by way of some careless comment. Well, God gave me a ticket on the freeway today, or something like that. Ensnared, Fat would leap into action. We whiled away the time pleasantly in this fashion, torturing Fat in a benign way. After we left his place, we had the added satisfaction of knowing he was writing it all down in the journal. Of course, in the journal, his view always prevailed. No need existed to bait Fat with idle questions, such as, if God can do anything, can he create a ditch so wide he can't jump over it? We had plenty of real questions that Fat couldn't field. Our friend Kevin always began his attack one way. "What about my dead cat?" Kevin would ask. Several years ago, Kevin had been out walking his cat in the early evening. Kevin, the fool, had not put the cat on a leash, and the cat had dashed into the street and right into the front wheel of a passing car. When he picked up the remains of the cat, it was still alive, breathing in bloody foam and staring at him in horror. Kevin liked to say, "On Judgment Day, when I'm brought up before the great judge, I'm going to say, 'Hold on a second,' and then I'm going to whip out my dead cat from inside my coat. 'How do you explain this?' I'm going to ask." By then, Kevin used to say, the cat would be as stiff as a frying pan. He would hold out the cat by its handle, its tail, and wait for a satisfactory answer. Fat said, "No answer would satisfy you." "No answer you could give," Kevin sneered. "Okay, so God saved your son's life. Why didn't he have my cat run out into the street 5 seconds later? 3 seconds later? Would that have been too much trouble? Of course, I suppose a cat doesn't matter." "You know, Kevin," I pointed out one time, "you could have put the cat on a leash." "No," Fat said, "he has a point. It's been bothering me. For him, the cat is a symbol of everything about the universe he doesn't understand." "I understand fine," Kevin said bitterly. "I just think it's fucked. God is either powerless, stupid, or he doesn't give a shit. Or all three. He's evil, dumb, and weak. I think I'll start my own exegesis." "But God doesn't talk to you," I said. "You know who talks to horse?" Kevin said. "Who really talks to horse in the middle of the night? People from the planet Stupid. Horse, what's the wisdom of God called again? Saint what?"
"Hagia Sophia," Horse said cautiously.
Kevin said, "How do you say Hagia Stupid? Saint Stupid?"
"Hagia Moron," Horse said. He always defended himself by giving in. "Moron is a Greek word like Hagia. I came across it when I was looking up the spelling of oxymoron."
"Except that the O-N suffix is the neuter ending," I said. That gives you an idea of where our theological arguments tended to wind up. Three malinformed people disagreeing with one another. We also had David, our Roman Catholic friend, and the girl who had been dying of cancer, Sherry. She had gone into remission, and the hospital had discharged her. To some extent, her hearing and vision were permanently impaired, but otherwise she seemed to be fine. Fat, of course, used this as an argument for God and God's healing love, as did David and, of course, Sherry herself. Kevin saw her remission as a miracle of radiation therapy and chemotherapy and luck. Also, he confided to us, the remission was temporary. At any time, Sherry could get sick again. Kevin hinted darkly that the next time she got sick, there wouldn't be a remission. We sometimes thought that he hoped so, since it would confirm his view of the universe. It was a mainstay of Kevin's bag of verbal tricks that the universe consisted of misery and hostility and would get you in the end. He looked at the universe the way most people regard an unpaid bill. Eventually, they will force payment. The universe reeled you out, let you flop and thrash, and then reeled you in. Kevin waited constantly for this to begin with him, with me, with David, and especially with Sherry. As to Horse Lover Fat, Kevin believed that the line hadn't been played out in years. Fat had long been in the part of the cycle where they reel you back in. He considered Fat not just potentially doomed, but doomed in fact. Fat had the good sense not to discuss Gloria Knudsen and her death in front of Kevin. Had he done so, Kevin would add her to his dead cat. He would be talking about whipping her out from under his coat on Judgment Day, along with the cat. Being a Catholic, David always traced everything wrong back to man's free will. This used to annoy even me. I once asked him if Sherry getting cancer consisted of an instance of free will, knowing as I did that David kept up with all the latest news in the field of psychology, and would make the mistake of claiming that Sherry had subconsciously wanted to get cancer, and so had shut down her immune system, a view floating around in advanced psychological circles at that time. Sure enough, David fell for it and said so. "Then why did she get well?" I asked.
Did she subconsciously want to get well? David looked perplexed. If he consigned her illness to her own mind, he was stuck with having to consign her remission to mundane and not supernatural causes. God had nothing to do with it. What C.S. Lewis would say, David began, which at once angered Fat, who was present. It maddened him when David turned to C.S. Lewis to bolster his straight-down-the-pipe orthodoxy. Maybe Sherry overrode God, I said. God wanted her sick, and she fought to get well. The thrust of David's impending argument would, of course, be that Sherry had neurotically gotten cancer due to being fucked up, but God had stepped in and saved her. I had turned it around in anticipation. No, Fat said. It's the other way around, like when he cured me. Fortunately, Kevin was not present. He did not consider Fat cured, nor did anyone else. And anyway, God didn't do it. That is a logic which Freud attacks, by the way, the two-proposition self-canceling structure. Freud considered this structure a revelation of rationalization. Someone is accused of stealing a horse, to which he replies, "I don't steal horses, and anyhow, you have a crummy horse." If you ponder the reasoning in this, you can see the actual thought process behind it. The second statement does not reinforce the first. It only looks like it does. In terms of our perpetual theological disputations, brought on by Fat's supposed encounter with the divine, the two-proposition self-canceling structure would appear like this. 1. God does not exist. 2. And anyhow, he's stupid. A careful study of Kevin's cynical rantings reveals this structure at every turn. David continually quoted C.S. Lewis. Kevin contradicted himself logically in his zeal to defame God. Fat made obscure references to information fired into his head by a beam of pink light. Sherry, who had suffered dreadfully, wheezed out pious mummeries. I switched my position according to who I was talking to at the time. None of us had a grip on the situation, but we did have a lot of free time to waste in this fashion. By now, the epoch of drug-taking had ended, and everyone had begun casting about for a new obsession. For us, the new obsession, thanks to Fat, was theology. A favorite antique quotation of Fat's goes, "And can I think the great Jehovah sleeps, like Shemosh and such fabled deities? Ah, no, heaven heard my thoughts and wrote them down. It must be so." Fat doesn't like to quote the rest of it. "'Tis this that racks my brain, and pours into my breast a thousand pangs that lash me into madness." It's from an aria by Handel. Fat and I used to listen to my Seraphim LP of Richard Lewis singing it, deeper and deeper still. Once I told Fat that another aria on the record described his mind perfectly. "Which aria?" Fat said guardedly. "Total eclipse," I answered. "Total eclipse, no sun, no moon, all dark amidst the blaze of noon. O glorious light, no cheering ray to glad my eyes with welcome day. Why, thus deprived thy prime decree, sun, moon, and stars are dark to me." To which Fat said, "The opposite is true in my case. I am illuminated by holy light fired at me from another world. I see what no other man sees." He had a point there. 3. A question we had to learn to deal with during the dope decade was, how do you break the news to someone that his brains are fried? This issue had now passed over into horse lover Fat's theological world as a problem for us, his friends, to field. It would have been simple to tie the two together in Fat's case. The dope he did during the 60s had pickled his head on into the 70s. If I could have arranged it so that I could think so, I would have. I like solutions that answer a variety of problems simultaneously. But I really couldn't think so. Fat hadn't done psychedelics, at least not to any real extent. Once, in 1964, when Sandoz LSD-25 could still be acquired, especially in Berkeley, Fat had dropped one huge hit of it, and had abreacted back in time, or had shot forward in time, or up outside of time. Anyhow, he had spoken in Latin,
and believed that the dies irae, the day of wrath, had come. He could hear God thumping tremendously in fury. For 8 hours, Fat had prayed and whined in Latin. Later, he claimed that during his trip he could only think in Latin and talk in Latin. He had found a book with a Latin quotation in it, and could read it as easily as he normally read English. Well, perhaps the etiology of his later God madness lay there. His brain, in 1964, liked the acid trip and taped it for future replay. On the other hand, this line of reasoning merely relegates the question back to 1964. As far as I can determine, the ability to read, think, and speak in Latin is not normal for an acid trip. Fat knows no Latin. He can't speak it now. He couldn't speak it before he dropped the huge hit of Sandoz LSD-25. Later, when his religious experiences began, he found himself thinking in a foreign language which he did not understand. He had understood his own Latin in 64. Phonetically, he had written down some of the words, remembered at random. To him, they constituted no language at all, and he hesitated to show anyone what he had put on paper. His wife, his later wife, Beth, had taken a year of Greek in college, and she recognized what Fat had written down, inaccurately, as Koine Greek, or at least Greek of some sort, Attic or Koine. The Greek word Koine simply means common. By the time of the New Testament, the Koine had become the lingua franca of the Middle East, replacing Aramaic, which had previously supplanted Akkadian. I know these things because I am a professional writer, and it is essential that I possess a scholarly knowledge about languages. The New Testament manuscripts survived in Koine Greek, although probably Q, the source of the synoptics, had been written in Aramaic, which is in fact a form of Hebrew. Jesus spoke Aramaic. Thus, when horse-lover Fat began to think in Koine Greek, he was thinking in the language which St. Luke and St. Paul, who were close friends, had used, at least to write with. The Koine looks funny when written down because the scribes left no spaces between the words. This can lead to a lot of peculiar translations, since the translator gets to put the spaces wherever he feels is appropriate, or in fact, wherever he wants. Take this English instance. God is nowhere. God is now here. Actually, these matters were pointed out to me by Beth, who never took Fat's religious experiences seriously until she saw him write down phonetically several words of the Koine, which she knew he had no experience with and could not recognize even as a genuine language. What Fat claimed was, well, Fat claimed plenty. I must not start any sentence with what Fat claimed was. During the years, outright years, that he labored on his exegesis, Fat must have come up with more theories than there are stars in the universe. Every day he developed a new one, more cunning, more exciting, and more fucked. God, however, remained a constant theme. Fat ventured away from belief in God the way a timid dog I once owned had ventured off its front lawn. He, both of them, would go first one step, then another, then perhaps a third, and then turn tail and run frantically back to familiar territory. God, to Fat, constituted a territory which he had staked out. Unfortunately for him, following the initial experience, Fat could not find his way back to that territory. They ought to make it a binding clause that if you find God, you get to keep him. For Fat, finding God, if indeed he did find God, became ultimately a bummer, a constantly diminishing supply of joy, sinking lower and lower, like the contents of a bag of uppers. Who deals God? Fat knew that the churches couldn't help, although he did consult with one of David's priests. It didn't work. Nothing worked. Kevin suggested dope. Being involved with literature, I recommended he read the English 17th century minor metaphysical poets, such as Vaughan and Herbert. He knows he hath a home, but scarce knows where. He says it is so far that he hath quite forgot how to go there. Which is from Vaughan's poem, Man. As nearly as I could make out, Fat had devolved to the level of those poets, and had, for these times, become an anachronism. The universe has a habit of deleting anachronisms. I saw this coming for Fat if he didn't get his shit together. Of all the suggestions given to Fat, the one that seemed most promising came from Sherry, who still lingered on with us in a state of remission. "What you should do," she told Fat during one of his darker hours, "is get into studying the characteristics of the T-34. Fat asked what that was. It turned out that Sherry had read a book on Russian armor during World War II. The T-34 tank had been the Soviet Union's salvation, and thereby the salvation of all the Allied powers, and, by extension, horse-lover Fats, since without the T-34 he would be speaking not English or Latin or the Koine, but German. "The T-34, Sherry explained, moved very rapidly. At Kursk, they knocked out even Porsche Elephants. You have no idea what they did to the 4th Panzer Army." She then started drawing sketches of the situation at Kursk in 1943, giving figures. Fat and the rest of us were mystified. This was a side of Sherry we hadn't known. "It took Zhukov himself to turn the tide against the Panzers," Sherry wheezed on. "Vatutin screwed up. He was later murdered by pro-Nazi partisans. Now consider the Tiger tank the Germans had, and their Panthers." She showed us photographs of various tanks and related with relish how General Konev had successfully crossed the Dniester and Prut rivers by March 26th. Basically, Sherry's idea had to do with bringing Fat's mind down from the cosmic and the abstract to the particular. She had hatched out the practical notion that nothing is more real than a large World War II Soviet tank. She wanted to provide an antitoxin to Fat's madness. However, her recitation, complete with maps and photographs, only served to remind him of the night he and Bob had seen the movie Patton before attending Gloria's graveside service. Naturally, Sherry had not known about that. "I think he should take up sewing," Kevin said. "Don't you have a sewing machine, Sherry? Teach him to use it." Sherry, showing a high degree of stubbornness, continued, "The tank battles at Kursk involved over 4,000 armored vehicles. It was the greatest battle of armor in history. Everyone knows about Stalingrad, but nobody knows about Kursk. The real victory by the Soviet Union took place at Kursk. When you consider..." "Kevin," David interrupted, "what the Germans should have done was show the Russians a dead cat and ask them to explain it." "That would have stopped the Soviet offensive right there," I said. "Zhukov would still be trying to account for the cat's death." To Kevin, Sherry said, "In view of the stunning victory by the good side at Kursk, how can you complain about one cat?" "There's something in the Bible about falling sparrows," Kevin said, "about his eye being on them. That's what's wrong with God. He only has one eye." "Did God win the battle at Kursk?" I said to Sherry. "That must be news to the Russians, especially the ones who built the tanks and drove them and got killed." Sherry said patiently, "God uses us as instruments through which he works." "Well," Kevin said, "regarding Horse, God has a defective instrument. Or maybe they're both defective, like an 80-year-old lady driving a Pinto with a drop-in gas tank." "The Germans would have had to hold up Kevin's dead cat," Fat said. "Not just any dead cat. All Kevin cares about is that one cat." "That cat," Kevin said, "did not exist during World War II. "Did you grieve over him then?" Fat said. "How could I?" Kevin said. "He didn't exist." "Then his condition was the same as now," Fat said. "Wrong," Kevin said. "Wrong in what way?" Fat said. "How did his non-existence then differ from his non-existence now?" "Kevin's got the corpse now," David said, "to hold up. That was the whole point of the cat's existence. He lived to become a corpse by which Kevin could refute the goodness of God." "Kevin," Fat said, "who created your cat?" "God did," Kevin said. "So God created a refutation of his own goodness," Sherry said, "by your logic." "God is stupid," Kevin said. "We have a stupid deity. I've said that before." Sherry said, "Does it take much skill to create a cat?" "You just need two cats," Kevin said, "one male and one female." But he could obviously see where she was leading him. "It takes..." He paused, grinning. "Okay, it takes skill if you presume purpose in the universe."
You don't see any purpose? Sherry said.
Hesitating, Kevin said, Living creatures have purpose.
Who puts the purpose in them?
Sherry said. They... Again, Kevin hesitated. They are their purpose. They and their purpose can't be separated.
So an animal is an expression of purpose, Sherry said. So there is purpose in the universe.
In small parts of it.
And unpurpose gives rise to purpose.
Kevin eyed her. Eat shit, he said. In my opinion, Kevin's cynical stance had done more to ratify Fat's madness than any other single factor. Any other, that is, than the original cause, whatever that might have been. Kevin had become the unintentional instrument of that original cause, a realization which had not escaped Fat. In no way, shape, or form did Kevin represent a viable alternative to mental illness. His cynical grin had about it the grin of death. He grinned like a triumphant skull. Kevin lived to defeat life. It originally amazed me that Fat would put up with Kevin, but later I could see why. Every time Kevin tore down Fat's system of delusions, mocked them and lampooned them, Fat gained strength. If mockery were the only antidote to his malady, he was palpably better off as he stood. Whacked out as he was, Fat could see this. Actually, were the truth known, Kevin could see it too. But he evidently had a feedback loop in his head that caused him to step up the attacks rather than abandon them. His failure reinforced his efforts. So the attacks grew, and Fat's strength grew. It resembled a Greek myth. In Horse Lover Fat's exegesis, the theme of this issue is put forth over and over again. Fat believed that a streak of the irrational permeated the entire universe, all the way up to God, or the ultimate mind, which lay behind it. He wrote, 38. From loss and grief, the mind has become deranged. Therefore, we, as parts of the universe, the brain, are partly deranged. Obviously, he had extrapolated into cosmic proportions from his own loss of Gloria. 35. The mind is not talking to us, but by means of us. Its narrative passes through us, and its sorrow infuses us irrationally. As Plato discerned, there is a streak of the irrational in the world soul. Entry 32 gives more on this. The changing information which we experience as world is an unfolding narrative. It tells about the death of a woman, italics mine. This woman, who died long ago, was one of the primordial twins. She was one half of the divine syzygy. The purpose of the narrative is the recollection of her and of her death. The mind does not wish to forget her. Thus the ratiocination of the brain consists of a permanent record of her existence, and, if read, will be understood this way. All the information processed by the brain, experienced by us as the arranging and rearranging of physical objects, is an attempt at this preservation of her. Stones and rocks and sticks and amoebae are traces of her. The record of her existence and passing is ordered onto the meanest level of reality by the suffering mind, which is now alone. If in reading this you cannot see that Fat is writing about himself, then you understand nothing. On the other hand, I am not denying that Fat was totally whacked out. He began to decline when Gloria phoned him, and he continued to decline forever and ever. Unlike Sherry and her cancer, Fat experienced no remission. Encountering God was not a remission, but probably it wasn't a worsening, despite Kevin's cynical views. You cannot say that an encounter with God is to mental illness what death is to cancer, the logical outcome of a deteriorating illness process. The technical term, theological technical term, not psychiatric, is theophany. A theophany consists of a self-disclosure by the divine. It does not consist of something the percipient does. It consists of something the divine, the God or gods, the high power, does. Moses did not create the burning bush. Elijah on Mount Horeb did not generate the low murmuring voice. How are we to distinguish a genuine theophany from a mere hallucination on the part of the percipient? If the voice tells him something he does not know and could not know, then perhaps we are dealing with the genuine thing and not the spurious. Fat knew no Koine Greek. Does this prove anything? He did not know about his son's birth defect, at least not consciously. Perhaps he knew about the near-strangulated hernia unconsciously and simply did not want to face it. There exists, too, a mechanism by which he might have known the Koine. It has to do with phylogenic memory, the experience of which has been reported by Jung. He terms it the collective or racial unconscious. The ontogeny, that is, the individual, recapitulates the phylogeny, that is, the species. And since this is generally accepted, then maybe here lies a basis for Fat's mind serving up a language spoken 2,000 years ago. If there were phylogenic memories buried in the individual human mind, this is what you might expect to find. But Jung's concept is speculative. No one, really, has been able to verify it. If you grant the possibility of a divine entity, you cannot deny it the power of self-disclosure. Obviously, any entity or being worthy of the term God would possess, without effort, that ability. The real question, as I see it, is not why theophanies, but why aren't there more? The key concept to account for this is the idea of the Deus absconditus, the hidden, concealed, secret, or unknown God. For some reason, Jung regards this as a notorious idea. But if God exists, he must be a Deus absconditus, with the exception of his rare theophanies, or else he does not exist at all. The latter view makes more sense, except for the theophanies, rare though they be. All that is required is one absolutely verified theophany, and the latter view is voided. The vividness of the impression which a supposed theophany makes on the percipient is no proof of authenticity, nor really is group perception, as Spinoza supposed the entire universe may be one theophany. But then again, the universe may not exist at all, as the Buddhist idealists decided. Any given alleged theophany may be a fake, because anything may be a fake, from stamps to fossil skulls to black holes in space. That the entire universe, as we experience it, could be a forgery, is an idea best expressed by Heraclitus. Once you have taken his notion, or doubt, into your head, you are ready to deal with the issue of God. It is necessary to have understanding, noos, in order to be able to interpret the evidence of eyes and ears. The step from the obvious to the latent truth is like the translation of utterances in a language which is foreign to most men. Heraclitus, in Fragment 56, says that men, in regard to knowledge of perceptible things, are the victims of illusion much as Homer was. To reach the truth from the appearances, it is necessary to interpret, to guess the riddle. But though this seems to be within the capacity of men, it is something most men never do. Heraclitus is very vehement in his attacks on the foolishness of ordinary men, and of what passes for knowledge among them. They are compared to sleepers in private worlds of their own. Thus says Edward Hussey, lecturer in ancient philosophy at the University of Oxford, and a fellow of All Souls College, in his book The Pre-Socratics, published by Charles Scribner's Sons, New York, 1972, pages 37 to 38. In all my reading, Horse Lover Fat has, never found anything more significant as an insight into the nature of reality. In Fragment 123, Heraclitus says, "The nature of things is in the habit of concealing itself." And in Fragment 54, he says, "Latent structure is master of obvious structure." To which Edward Hussey adds, "Consequently, he, Heraclitus, necessarily agreed that reality was to some extent hidden." So if reality is to some extent hidden, then what is meant by theophany? Because a theophany is an inbreaking of God, an inbreaking which amounts to an invasion of our world. And yet our world is only seeming. It is only obvious structure which is under the mastery of unseen latent structure. Horse Lover Fat would like you to consider this above all other things. Because if Heraclitus is correct, there is in fact no reality but that of Theophanes. The rest is illusion, in which case Fat alone among us comprehends the truth, and Fat, starting with Gloria's phone call, is insane. Insane people, psychologically defined, not legally defined, are not in touch with reality. Horse Lover Fat is insane, therefore he is not in touch with reality. Entry number 30 from his exegesis. The phenomenal world does not exist. It is a hypostasis of the information processed by the mind. 35. The mind is not talking to us, but by means of us. Its narrative passes through us, and its sorrow infuses us irrationally. As Plato discerned, there is a streak of the irrational in the world's soul. In other words, the universe itself, and the mind behind it, is insane. Therefore, someone in touch with reality is, by definition, in touch with the insane, infused by the irrational. In essence, Fat monitored his own mind and found it defective. He then, by the use of that mind, monitored outer reality, that which is called the macrocosm. He found it defective as well. As the Hermetic philosophers stipulated, the macrocosm and the microcosm mirror each other faithfully. Fat, using a defective instrument, swept out a defective subject, and from this sweep got back the report that everything was wrong. And in addition, there was no way out. The interlocking between the defective instrument and the defective subject produced another perfect Chinese finger trap. Caught in his own maze, like Daedalus, who built the labyrinth for King Minos of Crete and then fell into it and couldn't get out. Presumably Daedalus is still there, and so are we. The only difference between us and Horse Lover Fat is that Fat knows his situation, and we do not. Therefore, Fat is insane, and we are normal. They are compared to sleepers in private worlds of their own, as Hussey put it, and he would know. He is the foremost living authority on ancient Greek thought, with the possible exception of Francis Cornford. And it is Cornford who says that Plato believed that there was an element of the irrational in the world soul. Note, Plato's Cosmology, The Timaeus of Plato, Library of Liberal Arts, New York, 1937. End of note. There is no route out of the maze. The maze shifts as you move through it, because it is alive. Parsifal. I move only a little, yet already I seem to have gone far. Gournemanz. You see, my son, here time turns into space. The whole landscape becomes indistinct. A forest ebbs out, and a wall of rough rock ebbs in, through which can be seen a gateway. The two men pass through the gateway. What happened to the forest? The two men did not really move. They did not go anywhere, and yet they are not now where they originally were. Here time turns into space. Wagner began Parsifal in 1845. He died in 1873, long before Hermann Minkowski postulated four-dimensional space-time, 1908. The source basis for Parsifal consisted of Celtic legends and Wagner's research into Buddhism for his never-written opera about the Buddha to be called The Victors, Die Sieger. Where did Richard Wagner get the notion that time could turn into space? And if time can turn into space, can space turn into time? In Mircea Eliade's book Myth and Reality, one chapter is titled Time Can Be Overcome. It is a basic purpose of mythic ritual and sacrament to overcome time. Horse Lover Fat found himself thinking in a language used 2,000 years ago, the language in which St. Paul wrote, "Here time turns into space." Fat told me another feature of his encounter with God. All of a sudden, the landscape of California, USA, 1974, ebbed out, and the landscape of Rome of the first century CE ebbed in. He experienced a superimposition of the two for a while, like techniques familiar in movies, in photography. Why? How? God explained many things to Fat, but he never explained that, except for this cryptic statement. It is Journal Listing 3. He causes things to look different, so it would appear time has passed. Who is he? Are we to infer that time has not, in fact, passed? And did it ever pass? Was there once a real time, and for that matter, a real world? And now there is counterfeit time and a counterfeit world, like a sort of bubble growing and looking different, but actually static? Horse lover Fat saw fit to list this statement early in his journal, or exegesis, or whatever he calls it. Journal Listing 4, the next entry, goes, "Matter is plastic in the face of mind." Is any world out there at all? For all intents and purposes, Gournemanth and Parsifal stand still, and the landscape changes, so they become located in another space, a space which formerly had been experienced as time. Fat thought in a language of 2,000 years ago, and saw the ancient world appropriate to that language. The inner contents of his mind matched his perceptions of the outer world. Some kind of logic seems involved here. Perhaps a time dysfunction took place. But why didn't his wife Beth experience it too? She was living with him when he had his encounter with the divine. For her, nothing changed, except, as she told me, she heard strange popping sounds, like something overloaded, objects pushed to the point where they exploded, as if jammed, jammed with too much energy. Both Fat and his wife told me another aspect of those days, in March 1974. Their pet animals underwent a peculiar metamorphosis. The animals looked more intelligent and more peaceful. That is, until both animals died of massive malignant tumors. Both Fat and his wife told me one thing about their pets which has stuck in my mind ever since. During that time, the animals seemed to be trying to communicate with them, trying to use language. That cannot be written off as part of Fat's psychosis, that and the animal's death. The first thing that went wrong, according to Fat, had to do with the radio. Listening to it one night, he had not been able to sleep for a long time, he heard the radio saying hideous words, sentences which it could not be saying. Beth, being asleep, missed that, so that could have been Fat's mind breaking down. By then, his psyche was disintegrating at a terrible velocity. Mental illness is not funny. 4. Following his spectacular suicide attempt with the pills, the razor-sharp blade, and the car engine, all this due to Beth taking their son Christopher and leaving him, Fat found himself locked up in the Orange County Mental Hospital. An armed cop had pushed him in a wheelchair from the cardiac intensive care ward through the underground corridor which connected with the psychiatric wing. Fat had never been locked up before. From the 49 tablets of digitalis, he had suffered several days of PAT arrhythmia, since his efforts had yielded maximum dig toxicity, listed on the scale as 3. Digitalis had been prescribed for him to counter an hereditary PAT arrhythmia, but nothing such as he experienced while dig toxic. It's ironic that an overdose of digitalis induces the very arrhythmia it is used to counteract. At one point, while Fat lay on his back gazing up at the cathode tube screen over his head, a straight line showed. His heart had stopped beating. He continued to watch, and finally the trace dot resumed its waveform. The mercies of God are infinite. So, in a weakened condition, he arrived under armed guard at the psychiatric lockup, where he soon found himself sitting in a corridor breathing vast amounts of cigarette smoke and shaking, both from fatigue and fear. That night he slept on a cot, 6 cots to a room, and discovered that his cot came equipped with leather manacles. The door had been propped open to the corridor so the psych techs could keep watch over the patients. Fat could see the commercial TV set, which remained on. Johnny Carson's guest turned out to be Sammy Davis, Jr. Fat lay watching, wondering how it felt to have one glass eye. At that point he had no insight into his situation. He understood that he had survived the dig toxicity. He understood that for all intents and purposes he was now under arrest for his suicide attempt. He had no idea what Beth had been doing during the time he lay in the cardiac intensive care ward. She had neither called nor come to visit him. Sherry had come first, then David. No one else knew. Fat particularly did not want Kevin to know, because Kevin would show up and be cynical at his, Fat's, expense, and he wasn't in any condition to receive cynicism, even if it were well meant. The chief cardiologist at the Orange County Medical Center had exhibited Fat to a whole group of student doctors from UC Irvine. OCMC was a teaching hospital. They all wanted to listen to a heart laboring under 49 tabs of high-grade digitalis. Also, he had lost blood from the slash on his left wrist. What had saved his life initially emanated from a defect in the choke of his car. The choke hadn't opened properly as the engine warmed, and finally the engine had stalled. Fat had made his way unsteadily back into the house and lain down on his bed to die. The next morning he woke up, still alive, and had begun to vomit up the digitalis. That was the second thing which saved him. The third thing came in the form of all the paramedics in the world removing the glass and aluminum sliding door at the rear of Fat's house. Fat had phoned his pharmacy somewhere along the line to get a refill on his Librium prescription. He had taken 30 Librium just before taking the digitalis. The pharmacist had contacted the paramedics. A lot can be said for the infinite mercies of God, but the smarts of a good pharmacist, when you get down to it, is worth more. After one night in the receiving ward of the psychiatric wing of the county medical hospital, Fat underwent his automatic evaluation. A whole host of well-dressed men and women confronted him. Each held a clipboard, and all of them scrutinized him intently. Fat put on the trappings of sanity as best he could. He did everything possible to convince them that he had regained his senses. As he spoke, he realized that nobody believed him. He could have delivered his monologue in Swahili with equal effect. All he managed to do was abase himself and thereby divest himself of his last remnant of dignity. He had stripped away his self-respect by his own earnest efforts. Another Chinese finger trap. "Fuck it," Fat said to himself finally, and ceased talking. "Go outside," one of the psych techs said, "and we'll let you know our decision." "I really have learned my lesson," Fat said as he rose and started out of the room. "Suicide represents the introjection of hostility which should better be directed outward at the person who has frustrated you." End of Side 1. To continue, turn the cassette over.